Hello, and welcome to the Love Mia Vita podcast. I'm Jerry DiPiano, CEO of FemPharma. Thank you for joining me as we discuss all things women's health and wellness. Please note that this information is simply that. It's information to help you to think through your decisions. Please consult your medical practitioner to discuss your personal situation. Thank you. Dr. Moore is my guest today on the Love Mia Vita podcast, and Dr. Moore is also one of our medical advisory board members at FemPharma. Today's topic is about disparities in maternal fetal health, and the topic of maternal health is an area where Dr. Moore has great expertise among many areas. But Shawana, please share with our guests, our listeners, a bit about your background.
Sure. And Jerry, thanks so much for having me here today to talk about such a critical topic across our country. So I am Dr. Shawana Moore. I'm a women's health nurse practitioner by training. But more importantly, I'm a survivor of a traumatic birthing experience. And I share my story to bring attention to the disparities and inequities around birthing people across our country, specifically Black women. And not only just storytelling, but really to create and move the needle around advocacy and shifting of practices when it comes to engaging with diverse women who have the ability to give birth, and more specifically, Black women. There is a lot of data out there that we read about, we hear about, but it's really, what do we do with it? So my hope is that talking about this issue really leads to shifting the narrative on how Black and brown women experience maternal health and birthing outcomes.
Thank you for that. And we unfortunately have heard this numerous times. There's a lot of data that is available that talks about how maternal mortality rates have increased. I'm reading something that I picked up from the Centers for Disease Control. The maternal mortality rate has increased significantly from 2020, from 20.1 deaths per 100,000 live births to 23.3.
Wow.
Now, women of color in the United States, regardless of economic or educational status, are 3 to 5 times more likely to die from pregnancy-related causes than white women. And let's just be frank about this. When we talk about women of color, we are talking about Black and brown women. We're not talking about other racial groups. And I think that's important. It's not to say that we don't care about maternal mortality and fetal outcomes for all women. Mm-hmm. We are particularly concerned about what this means for Black and brown women, because mortality rate increased in Black women from 44 to 55.3 per 100,000 live births during the period from 2019 to 2020. And that's from the CDC. We obviously have a real problem on our hands. And so why does this problem exist? What is the, what are the mediators of this? So I think we want to talk about that, and perhaps you want to share your personal experience, because you are an extraordinarily well-educated woman. You are a nurse, doctor of nursing practice with multiple degrees. I think there's alphabet soup behind your name. So you're well-educated. You're not socioeconomically disadvantaged, but you share with us that you had your own trauma.
Yeah, and it's very disappointing. We live in the United States, is one of the best countries in the world, right? And we rise to the bar and rise to the occasion with other areas. But when it comes to maternal health, and specifically Black maternal health, we fail these individuals. And it's one of the ugly things that I think we have to really reckon with in the United States, and that's racism. I think it's something that we still have yet to really reckon with and really address. And that really is the core issue that leads to such a disparity when you look at maternal health outcomes across our country. And in general, as you stated before, as a developed country, United States ranks horribly when it comes to maternal health outcomes in general. However, when you look at it from a race and ethnicity construct, we know that Black women disproportionately are affected by this issue. And why is it? And the key to that, and from my experience, is, and the literature states it as well, structural racism. Structural racism is at the core of it. And we really have to understand what that looks like within healthcare practices and healthcare settings. I think sometimes people confuse structural racism to be something as if someone is saying something like a racial slur, right? But it's not that. It's having certain structures in place that doesn't allow a certain individual from a certain race and ethnicity access it in the same ability as their white counterpart. It's healthcare providers being trained and having implicit bias and not having professional development around mitigating their implicit biases, right? So it's not this outwardly thing that people are verbally attacked because of their race and what they look like. These are silent structures that are in place that disproportionately impact certain populations of individuals who have the ability to give birth. And for this instance, it's Black women. We also know that systems, healthcare systems, don't necessarily provide an environment that is welcoming for Black and Brown birthing people. And that comes from the time that the individual walks in the door. Is there visualization of images of those people from their racial and ethnicity group visualized, right? When they come in, do they see themselves? Do they see healthcare providers that look like them? We know that when individuals or women, specifically Black women, engage with healthcare providers that look like them, healthcare outcomes tend to be better. I read this study recently about even surgeons, and this had nothing to do with race. It focused more on gender. When a woman has a female surgeon, her surgical outcomes are better. So we know that there's importance when it comes to being able to identify and feel a part of a group when it comes to healthcare. And our health systems really need to do a better job in ensuring that environments, healthcare providers really are aware and trained appropriately to care for diverse groups of women. You also hit on really important data when it comes to it hits across all lines, regardless of socioeconomic status, regardless of educational attainment. Data tells us that a white woman without a high school education will have a better health birthing outcome than a Black woman with a higher education attainment. And you say, how could this be? And again, I say, there are systems in place, there's implicit bias in place, there are structural systems in place that disproportionately impact a certain population of individuals. We know that Black women are historically an oppressed group of individuals in our state, in our country, right? So I think that it has a historical context that has yet to be broken completely and yet to be really reckoned with and acknowledged fully. And I think we have a lot of work to do to get there. I think there are a lot of people who have the conversations and are open to it. And it's been an ongoing thing, but now it's time to shift the narrative into action. We know these disparities exist. We see the data. We hear about the endless stories. And some stories people don't live to tell, right? I always say I'm blessed because I live to tell my story. My child lives, right? But if it had not been for me having a routine visit on that specific day, I could have died at home from severe preeclampsia because my healthcare providers dismissed my concerns. And at that point in my pregnancy, I was tired of engaging with healthcare and telling them what I was feeling and kind of just being gaslit and saying, oh, you're fine, just do these homeopathic things. And again, you hear about even high profile athletes. There was a track and field athlete who passed away from severe preeclampsia at home. And I say for me, I had an appointment that day. So that's the reason why I was rushed to OB triage to deliver. Otherwise, I know I was tired. I would have just stayed home and just waited it out because I was tired of engaging with the medical field at that point. So I say that to say a lot of women, Black women, suffer in silence when it comes to their pregnancies, their birthing experiences, and they leave with scars. I had the opportunity to talk in Philadelphia not too long ago to women. It was an uplifting event that happens in Philadelphia around women and how they engage in healthcare. And it really focuses on Black and Brown women. And, I had participants come up to me in tears afterwards saying, I had a traumatic birthing experience and it led me to want to become a doula to ensure what I experienced didn't happen to a person that looked like me. So there are people who come from diverse communities who are trying to engage in do their part to help change the problem. Now it's time for major health systems, right? And for policy and legislation to really support making that major shift so that the way Black and Brown women engage and experience healthcare can be more positive, right? And I always say people can survive physically from a traumatic birthing experience, right? But what happens to them emotionally and mentally? Those are scars that take a long time to heal, and those are scars that you don't necessarily see. And I even share this openly. My husband and I, we had a desire to have more children. We thought we would have at least two. But because of that birthing experience, we've been very reserved to go through a pregnancy journey again. And our son now is 8, so it's been a long time. And I say, yes, I physically heal, right? But that trauma from that experience, I don't know that I can see myself safe in healthcare, knowing that I can engage in healthcare and it'll be a positive experience and a positive outcome. And that's why I try to advocate about awareness of Black maternal health, the disparities and inequities, so that individuals don't experience what I experienced and don't have to shift their future plans for families, right? And those are the things people don't talk about. These are the unintended consequences that come from having negative birthing experiences. And I think it's important and critical to talk about and talk through.
So what do you think is the, we talked about the structural determinants, and you mentioned some of the structural determinants. Isn't it important that we recognize, when I say we, whether it's healthcare systems or providers of care, recognize our own cognitive bias? Because we may think that we have an understanding of what Black and brown women are experiencing, but we may come to this conversation with cognitive bias.
Yeah, and when I talk about implicit bias, I always say we all have it, right? And the biggest thing is having awareness that we have it and accepting it. I think sometimes as individuals, we want to do good, right? And we don't want something that seems so negative to be normalized, but it is normal. And I always say the beauty of like having a implicit bias or cognitive bias is that it's things you learn over time, right? And because you can learn it over time, you can unlearn it, but it takes effort, right? And it takes the first thing is an awareness that it does exist. And how do you mitigate that, right? And for even for me, as a Black woman, I have implicit bias. As a healthcare provider, I have implicit bias. And it's important for me when I'm engaging in with diverse groups of people, right? People who don't look like me. How do I ensure my biases go out the door when I am engaging with these patients, right? And again, there are various tools out there. Harvard has implicit bias and bias tests that individuals can take, and they have them in different areas. They have it on gender, they have it on race, so they have it on various areas. And again, when you take these assessments, you'll score differently each time, right? But the goal of it is to, okay, figure out what these biases are and how do I change that, right? I think it's something that has to really be a concerted and dedicated effort, and it's not just a continuing education. So, as healthcare providers, right, we have to get continuing education for our respective licensure. However, to me, this is something that should be built into health system where it's the norm. You have these sessions, you bring in guest speakers from different places within a region or country that can come talk about these issues. That is the ongoing commitment for healthcare providers to engage with. The other thing I think is important is even within our personal life, we have to stretch ourselves to talk to people who don't have the same belief systems as us, who don't look like us, because that, from a personal level, helps that to translate to us when we're in our professional settings. And I think that's something that I think is critical, and I don't know that we do it enough. I have a colleague who always says she practices in a specific area that it had a huge Asian population. So she says, you know what? I started to study. I started to go to different events in that area with that respective population to learn more because this was the population I was caring for. So how could I care for them if I had no points of identification, if I didn't understand their culture when it came to the foods that they took in, right? I'm sitting here diagnosing them with all these conditions and have this bias as to what they're doing, and they're doing it inappropriately, but this is their cultural practice. So she took it upon herself to say, I have to engage more, I have to learn more. And those are things we have to do, right? And I'm like, it sounds like a hard task, but it's not. I'm like, there's so much you can get involved with to learn about different people, to understand those practices of those respective people, so that that can help you translate to that within the clinical setting. That not only gives the patient a better experience and a better health outcome, but it ultimately makes you a better provider.
Along those lines, speaking as a healthcare practitioner and teach, and also as a professor teaching others, do you think there is a general comprehension of the social determinants of health? Because we want to think about empathy. So that I think that's where we're, you were going with this, is you can't have empathy unless you've actually immersed yourself and the understanding of what the community health issues are in your particular community, the community that you serve. And I use the word serve because let's face it, that's what those that are providing healthcare services do. They serve. That's why it's called healthcare services.
Exactly. That's so critical, and that's such an important point. When we think about social determinants of health, that's one of the core pieces, right? And where I teach at academically in Georgia, we had the opportunity to create a textbook that is centered in social determinants of health. So our curriculum for our students who become advanced practice registered nurses throughout the state of Georgia and beyond are grounded in understanding the social determinants of health. It's at the core of our curriculum. And again, if as healthcare providers, we don't truly understand the social determinants of health within that respective community, how do you have that empathy? How do you truly connect? And social determinants of health can be multiple layer, right? It has to do with education, their income, the actual physical environment, coping skills, healthcare services that are provided. I live in the state of Georgia, and outside of the Atlanta metropolitan area, healthcare is scarce. And when you think about maternal healthcare, it's even more scarce. So understanding what that looks like for the patients you serve will really change how you engage in it. So in clinic the other week, and one of my colleagues, she discussed how she had to change her language around saying the patient she served or non-compliant. She said, when my patient has to catch two buses, right? Has to drop their children off to childcare, has to think about paying a light bill. Do you think they're thinking about coming to get their colposcopy done? No, that's not on their radar. So I had to stop, she says, I had to stop labeling them as non-compliant, understand the social determinants of health factors that played on those things. And then for her, she writes for $1 million grants. So she said, I had to figure out how can I support my patients. So she wrote for grants, so to create a mobile unit to go out into the community and provide cervical cancer screening, HPV testing, and colposcopy services, right? So it's understanding what those social determinants of health are, and then coming up with meaningful solutions, right? I'm like, we chose the field of healthcare, so we chose the science centered around caring for people. Now, how do we bring sustainable solutions to address those social determinants of health to ensure the patients that we care for can obtain services that are needed?
And you talk about community-based ways in which to engage, and that's very important because let's face it, if you're living in a major metropolitan area, that doesn't necessarily mean that you still have access to the best teaching resources. Femfarma is based in just outside of Philadelphia. And if you live in certain areas, if Philadelphia, the city, while you may have major teaching institutions, they may be inaccessible to you for any number of reasons, some that you just illustrated. So having that ability to bring the services right to the neighborhood, right to the community centers is vitally important, particularly when you think about someone who may be pregnant, who might have more than one child, and maybe they just don't have access to transportation or they don't have the resources for transportation. So there's having that understanding and appreciation and being able to meet the woman where she lives is so critical. That's such an important aspect to delivery of care. We also know that in terms of health equity in general, that women today should be somewhat concerned. I wanted to get your thoughts on that. Obviously, we're at a pivotal time, and without getting too political, there are certain rights and privileges that have been taken away. Certain states restrict access to certain types of health care. What should women be thinking about right now?
Yeah, so maternal and reproductive health care and the state of women's health care across our country is one that is in a very critical state. It needs to be addressed. And we know with the overturn of Roe v. Wade, it really uncovered lots of disparities that were already being experienced by Black women. I reside in the state of Georgia, and just recently, two stories came out about two Black women, Amber Thurman and Candy Miller, who died from preventable deaths because of their inability to obtain services needed. And I say, when we place or when policies and lawmakers and legislators place any restriction on reproductive health care, it places the lives of women across our country at risk. And more alarming, those historically oppressed individuals, Black women specifically, are at a heightened disadvantage for experiences, those inequities. And I keep saying time and time again, how many more stories do we need to hear to understand the importance of having reproductive freedom? Again, when you ban any form of healthcare, women's healthcare, reproductive healthcare, you really risk the lives of countless women. And truly, within one of the most developed countries in the world, women deserve better. And us as a society deserve better. And I say it's not just a woman's issue, it's a everybody, every person's issue. So any restriction on healthcare, specifically reproductive healthcare, truly is detrimental to the health and well-being of women across our country.
It absolutely does. And obviously, we know what the demographics tell us. Women are still the dominant force. Women are the ones that contribute to the most value to the GDP. We are the ones that are at risk here, though. And we also need to make men understand that this is not solely a woman's problem. It is everyone's problem. I think you said it quite well. Every man who has a mother, a sister, a daughter should be concerned about these issues. And then we talk about the research. So the Society for Maternal and Fetal Medicine talks about the need for research. So let's think about the implications for what needs to be done. You illustrated a number of the gaps that exist in the way in which we approach disparities in maternal fetal health in a Black population. And when you look at what is required from a research perspective, we should undertake anti-racist activities in the same way that we pursue clinical biomedical research. And it is not inexpensive, nor is it trivial. We have so much work to be done. If we have the wrong administration, and I'm not just talking at the top, we will limit our ability to invest in the kind of research that can change this dynamic for Black women and Brown women and women in general. So we look at the consequences of that. And yet, what do we do? Because I always believe in leaving our listeners with hope. What should you do? What do you advise as a Black woman speaking to other Black women? What can they do right now? And what can they do to protect their future and their future generations?
So, Jerry, I think those are all critical and important points. And I think when I talk to people across the country through various venues, both from a healthcare provider to a healthcare provider, and from a woman, a Black woman to another group of Black women, I always say everyone has the ability to lead and make a change to address the problem when it comes to maternal mortality, specifically Black maternal mortality. So I say you have to figure out how do you lead from exactly where you are. And not everybody's the healthcare provider, right? People have other venues and other professions that you're in. But how do you begin to have critical conversations from where you are to shift the narrative? So it can be as simple as organizing a small gathering of individuals that you meet with through Zoom to talk through what women's health issues are occurring in your respective community? When's the next town hall meeting occurring where you're being in front of legislators, those policy individuals who have the ability to make policy changes, and you're able to bring forth those issues to address the maternal health crisis? It could be at something where you're creating a workforce task group within your respective employee in your place of employment, right? To address, talk about these critical issues and what you can do from a healthcare or not a healthcare, a committee within your respective organization that focuses on the well-being of Black and Brown women during pregnancy and postpartum, right? You also can engage with grassroots organizations that are local to your respective area to volunteer, whether that be making phone calls, right? Canvas in specific areas. The other thing is, if you work for a healthcare system, you can work towards developing a plan specifically around acknowledgement and assessing the disparities within your respective healthcare system. So, what could that look like? That could be something where you're formalizing a task group of individuals from across all of the specific maternal and infant units. Right. And you come together to look at the data that is around outcomes that are happening within your respective practice or healthcare system. And then looking at what could be the root causes of it. So, based on knowing that all of this is happening, what are the root causes? We know historically root causes have to do with implicit bias, structural racism, inadequate resources, inadequate training of healthcare providers in their team. So you want to, and everybody's factors could be different depending on their place of employment. The next thing you want to consider doing is developing a comprehensive plan, right? So you have all the data, you identify the root causes. Now, what is the comprehensive plan to address these issues, right? And last but not least, there should always be a monitoring and planning and evaluation, right? So you want to evaluate what the plan was. Is it working? How do you pivot? How do you change? But I think really for the public, it's understanding where you are within your respective role in the world, right? Even if you are a stay-at-home mom, if you're a school teacher, are you going to be on a PTA? Because believe it or not, policies happen there. Crucial conversations that impact wellness and reproductive health can start within being on a PTA. So I think understanding that you have the ability to contribute to change and meaningful conversations that can lead to change from exactly where you are is something, and that you just have to identify what that is for you. And it'll be different for everybody. But I always say the more ants, right, we have working towards the problem, the bigger the hill is to address the problem. And I always use ants because people look at ants as small, but when all of them go marching together, boy, are they powerful, and can they hold things up? So really it's understanding where you can lead from exactly where you are, because all of us are leaders within our respective room. It's just, what does that look like for me? Even if you're writing letters to your legislators about different resolutions that you are passionate about and that impact Black and Brown maternal health and women's health in general, that's a form of advocacy. That's a form of addressing the problem and making a change. The other thing I would say is using your voice. We have elections that happen all the time, both on a federal level, municipal level, right? So how do we ensure we use our voice during elections, right? So it's understanding the power we have within and putting that power towards action that can address the maternal health crisis that we're experiencing across our country. And the other thing I would say is allyship. As a Black woman, it's so important me to have allies that don't look like me. And Jerry, I look at you as an ally. You are an ally. And I say that to share that I have a student. She was my former student, and that was many years ago, over 8 years ago, because that's when I gave birth to Emory. But if it had not been for my student, who was a white woman, who was an ally, who advocated for me in the hospital to receive better care, again, the care that I received during a hospital would not have shifted. So I always say it's important to have allies who don't look like you, who can sit in a room and talk about problems that are impacting you and your racial or ethnic group. So allyship is key to addressing the problem as well. And I always say, although we know Black and Brown women have higher rates of maternal mortality and morbidity, Black women didn't cause that problem. So Black women can't solve that problem alone. We need all people, all allies, to work together to address this injustice that is experienced by Black and Brown women.
You said it beautifully. We need to support each other. We especially need to support women as women, irrespective of your race, ethnicity, sexual preference. We need to support one another. Madeleine Albright said there is a special place in hell for women who don't help other women. And I believe that it is our shared experience that also makes a difference. So you shared your story, and this is so important because what you learned could help many other women who are either listening in or women that with whom you've had conversations. And if you're at a PTA meeting, or you're in a women's group, or you're at your church, or you're with your girlfriends, sharing that experience and taking away some of what you learned to help them is so important. Banding together, our voices will be heard. And as they say in the Broadway musical, Suffs, keep marching.
Yes.
Keep marching. Persistence is pa and passion. That's what it's all about. Persistence and passion. Shawana, Dr. Moore, it is always a pleasure to have you with us on the Love Me Evita podcast, and we look forward to the next time.
Thank you so much for having me, Jerry.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us on the Love Me Evita podcast. Love Me Evita means love my life, and that is a mantra we should all live by. Please like and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and check out our website at fempharma.com. Remember to live well and love Mia Vita.